coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, and all the ships at sea, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. We got a good one for you this week. I am your host, Andrew Farmer. With me always, as always, is your other host.
Indeed.
He has a...
I'm sorry,
I didn't set that up right if you listened to the last issue. I'm Andrew Farmer.
And I'm Cole Houston, coming to you, of course, here ringside.
Listen, I've trained him in a Pavlovian fashion. And he only responds with his name if I say my name first. No,
it's like that obscure telephone. It would like ring these sleeper agents up in Russia and say some word, and all of a sudden, oh, sorry, honey, bye, kids. I gotta go kill people. Name motherland.
Yeah, well, you're definitely comic books Manchurian candidate.
Indeed.
Tonight, I'll let Cole explain this is his idea, and it was so brilliant when he brought the idea to the table and said, you know, this. Like, for instance, there's a difference between Cole's ideas and my ideas. I just posited an idea today that said, let's do a show about our favorite comic book covers. This is an audio podcast.
Imagine it, folks. Those of you listening at home, I'll describe the cover of the funny book, Actionomics.
But that's what makes it, awesome.
There's a bodybuilder type individual wearing tights and cape. It's carrying aloft a Studebaker.
I like that you do.
Hurling some bad guys while a man in the ground runs panic, holding the side's head for no notable reason.
I like the fact that you're doing every sheriff from every made-for-TV Stephen King movie that's ever been made.
There's a rabid dog on the side. I thought I'd let folks know before it ripped my throat out.
Studebaker? Is that the cast of Wings? Because they're in every made-for-TV.
Oh, geez.
Even
weren't you in Sideways?
By the way, so, off topic, because we haven't even talked about the topic yet. If you're not watching Legion, holy shit.
Oh, we are going to be doing a show. In fact, an idea I had not yet paused. You have to show Legion and, damn it, was another show that's not on Netflix.
It's not on Netflix. No.
It's a zero fair.
They did a... I would like to include Powerless in that run-up, because if you haven't watched Powerless yet, if you can get...
Apparently I need to be watching.
It's so funny. I'm not finished yet. I still haven't watched the last episode of Legion. I've watched...
That takes place in Cougar Town, right?
Yeah, it's Cougar Town.
Charm City,
Charm
right? There was
City.
Some trivia.
That was on my trivia. Yes, it was.
Yes.
Because it was supposed to, I was hoping to trick people because it was supposed to happen in Gotham up until like 2 weeks before they started shooting it, and then they decided to make it in Charm City. No, but I haven't watched the season finale yet. I've watched the second to the season finale, and I was literally jumped. There was a particular scene in the, if you're not watching Legion, in the lead up to the season finale where I was jumping up and down in my living room. Jumping up and down.
Oh, yes, indeed.
I was what? I was losing
wait till you
my
have
mind.
The podcast come finale.
Could have been the best reveal on a comic book TV show that I've ever seen. Besides Netflix. On a comic book TV show that I've ever seen in my life. Just what? But anyway.
It's kind of in that vein of seeing the Stiltman arm.
Right. But that was the
because you know
when,
you're never going to see him.
Don't never say never. Never say never. We saw Batroc the Leap Heir in a Marvel movie, my friend.
That is so true.
If there's one thing that we've learned from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, never, never say never. We're getting Mantis in a Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
Holy shit, yes.
Never say never. But yeah, that was the moment when I needed a towel in my living room from a TV show, which dovetails nicely into the topic of this particular issue of Hey Kids Comics, which is what, Cole?
This is that moment when, and it is an opportunity for us to wax gushing about those times where you're reading a comic, you're reading a series, and you literally put the thing down. Because it has struck such a chord, gone above and beyond, especially in the series, you think this is everything building toward in the last 100 years. And then you realize, holy crap, I have not known comics until this moment.
And that's a big one, I think, that needs to be mentioned, because we always talk about how we want to change your relationship with comics. Like, that's sort of the whole goal. Buy, sell, collect, and collect comics.
And not in one of those strange Mary body pillows.
Yeah, not in the movie Sleepwalkers kind of way, where the...
Not in a hurt.
Yes. No, we want you to really examine your dynamic of reading comics and enjoying comics. But there is a point in comics where the comics decide to change their dynamic with you without your consent, almost, where you're reading along and all of a sudden this happens and you...
Yeah, which has led to a series of memes, t-shirts and stuff that say, comics is not consent.
That's right. If it wouldn't get us so much hate mail.
Exactly.
So to give you an example of kind of what we're talking about. And we'll double back, but this week, historically, two things happened that I think changed the paradigm for comics. Number one, The Killing Joke came out in 88 this
week.
Oh,
wow. I didn't realize, yes. And somebody did their homework.
And this week as well. Today, as we record this, which this will be a tip of the hat to the day that we're recording it, the modern iteration of The Swamp Thing was released.
Ah, excellent.
So it's a good week.
Talk
to
about
do
that
this.
Moment when, yeah.
Yeah, this is a good week to do this. So, I'm sorry, I completely interrupted you by talking about...
Oh, no, that's... You actually upped my game a bit there by actually hard facts and mix. And by... I'm sorry, while we were recording, I put a cat back. She just sat down and fell off. She realized all this time he was carrying a treat around.
Speaking of, this is,
it's like finding a dollar in pocket.
Welcome
you didn't
to
realize
Hey Kids
was
Cats.
There.
That's what HK's, because I can do that. We have a cat that currently has an allergy problem in the house and wakes us up at 3 in the morning by sneezing no less than 50 times in a row.
Wow.
It's horrifying. It is nightmare fuel to wake up to.
It's that spritzer kind of sneeze cats have.
Yeah, it is just this cat just 50. No, I'm not joking. I've counted. I sat there and counted on my fingers. But anyway, we digress hilariously.
It's like a Shetland porch or something.
We missed the boat because it is April 1st as we're recording this. And
oh, that
we could have done Hey Kids Cats.
Well, that's true. Hey Kids Cats.
It's just cats.
Well, day on Hey Kids Cats. We'll talk about it. Left friend of ours.
We could have taken your calls. It would have been a
that's
whole
right.
thing. But anyway, we are. That's not what we're doing.
Last time on Cats Whisk,
we did an interview. With Rumble Bumble Bottoms.
And the most unlikely pairing, a duckling and a kitten, who are just inseparable.
Jaguars are just big tabbies. Find out.
Until they eat.
So, you won't believe number three.
Speaking of eating faith, literally, when you get those, and I'm sure that when I invoke that moment when, a lot of you probably had those little inexplicable chills that used to freak you when you were a child. And then some of the others had that kind of chill you get and realize something has hit home.
Right.
Basically, I have all had that experience. We may not have really made the connection that there were times when just a book made you say, wow.
Yeah.
And I'm hesitant here because I don't ever got any further to into Saga, because this is what inspired.
Well, and it did inspire, and you were definitely on me to finish the run, as it were. And I don't know how far in your moment when is, but the thing, so when we talk about books that, because Cole and I have been reading comics for cumulatively about 80 years, and that's not an exaggeration.
No, it isn't. Jimmy Olsen comic, Grandmother Had in Drawers, with a handful of other comics, so kiddos were by, you reread it like you're in some sort of prison and had a very limited library. Or,
but yeah, so the thing about Saga, and I am sure, I am positive that on this issue of Hey Kids Comics, you are going to hear Saga, you are going to hear Watchmen, you are going to hear Grant Morrison and Alan Moore, and one of the names that now I believe firmly should be mentioned in the same breath as your paradigm changers. I know I'm using that a lot. Alan Moore's and your Grant Morrison's and your Frank Miller's even.
Maybe
is,
your Matt Fractions. It's okay.
Matt,
you can say it. I'm waiting.
Your Matt Fractions is Brian K. Vaughan. Because oh, Saga absolutely. Has so many That Moment wins in it that you almost just, you can't.
It is a series moments win.
Right, so I don't know what your moment win from Saga is, but I could give you at least three. I've read through volume three, so I've read through the first three volumes of it. So I haven't read the last three volumes of it yet, but you can feel free to spoil away for me because it's not going to change anything when I get there. I'd have to put it down and walk away for a while like I've had to do like three times with that book.
But the thing is, in all fairness, you read a shit ton of books.
I do. I read comics every single night, just to stop my brain from screaming at me. But that's a whole different show.
There's a couple of them, but the one that inspired me, one that just not only made me put the book down when I was reading the latest collected volume, which I got back Thanksgiving. Thanks. So you're really far my ass. So
I really am. I need to catch up.
But there was a point where I'm drawing a blank on their kid's name.
That's all right.
The baby.
Right.
But I said, hey.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think
Hazel.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Point where Marco is finally with Hazel.
Okay.
And he arrives on the scene with her doll that he's carried with him for, at that point, it's probably a good couple of years. And he's, you know, holding it up, and he's reunited with his daughter after all this time. She has grown considerably. She was a little toddler, he saw ass. And they come, and they're reunited, and he's going through that sort of awkward, slip-slide-way, kind of apologetic awkwardness and feeling of being the abandoning, you know, the one who abandoned. And all that you get from Hazel is her just charging down, kind of just
right in the guts.
Oh my god, I'm practically weeping now, just telling you, it's hard to maintain composure because it's that power.
Yeah.
And it's a combination of on script, it's just amazing artwork because
so
she understands not only how to draw the body, but how to draw a body.
And she's one of those rare artists that, and we've talked about this on the show, I think we talked about it, we were talking about the kids episode, that knows how to draw children proportionately, not just little adults.
Yes.
So it has even a greater impact because of that.
Exactly. Because, Hazel looks like a child needs the Hazel to be in that. And you've seen aging the book. And of course, as the narrator, one of the other kind of moments when was at the end one of the chapters that became a trade paperback. And thankfully, I got into it late enough where I didn't have long-ass time to get the next one, was the Marcus first.
Oh,
and you get that wonderful cat. That's my grandparents with us.
Yeah.
Such a brilliant way of this is the end. Read this serially. This is the where you're going to have to wait a month.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
If you were just buying the trade paperback, you might have had to wait a year to get the next chapter. And it's just such wonderful. The whole thing is written like very good television.
And
a very good all-in-one.
We should say too that, you know, if you're and we'll make sure to note the post. But if you're listening to this, expect spoilers. If you haven't read these, you know, we'll try to put a list of the pertinent information up that you should read if you're going to listen to this issue, because we will be spoiling. You know,
that's
the whole point of this, is spoiling these events that kind of shook us as readers, and we want you to experience it as well. So you should read these books before you listen to the rest of this. But, you know, there are a couple, like, when I was reading it, the death of Marco's father.
Yes.
Was one that I literally had to kind of, you know, take a step away from the book.
What is wonderful there is you don't get a lot of Bar and Alana, his parents. But in that little time, at least up to that point, up to Bar's death, holy crap, you, like, know him.
Yeah. And then,
course, that's going to bring me to a point about his mom. But
yeah, and you do it, because I think I was going the same direction.
You might well have been. It's when they finally arrive, meet the Oswald heist.
Yes.
And they fairly freshly widowed Alana. And the Oswald heist, you begin to see there's something going on. And there's that wonderful scene where they are playing the board game.
Yes, that's the one that translates to
Nins Now. and the box art. I mean, I'd be honest, they've even got the idea of children board game box art from an alien civilization. So brilliantly, we had that little kid on the cover, like, he's yelling this phrase out, written different language, that they tell you in the story translates roughly now means now. It looks like, crap, that's exactly what the kid's yelling.
You're like, keep it still. And The other one that hit me the hardest in what I've read so far is a character that I know that, and I've only three issues in, so I only know what I've read. And if there's one thing I know about this book is they're going to surprise you. If that's what the book should be called, I'm Going to Surprise You by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples, is the ship that, I can't remember his name, the bounty hunter.
The stock, the will.
Well, the stock, the death of the stock was pretty. That was too soon into the book for you to really. Because the thing about this book is it's built on these moments when the whole series is. But the stock's death was pretty. But the will, there was a scene where the will ship is rent asunder, and the panel after it, while they're trying to, you know, there's like a three or four panel series of them trying to figure out what's going on, and the last panel is this ship rendered asunder. You see the outside view of space, and there's Lion Cat floating in space.
Yes.
And I was like, fuck this book. I can't.
You cannot kill Lion Cat. Like, you can kill everyone else in the book, top to bottom, but by God, Lion Cat's going to live till the last year.
You can commit comic genocide on this book, for all I care, as long as Lion Cat's on that last panel and it says lying, fine. But do not kill Lion Cat. And there's Lion Cat floating.
The whole series finale just needs to be called Saga featuring Lion Cat.
And you're reading those four. Here's the brilliant thing that they do is you're reading those four panels and you're realizing, because the way that it's set up, there's a suspense there that something's not right. It's not like, oh, the ship was ripped apart, but we're okay. You know, there's a suspense that something is missing. And as you're piecing together the puzzle, you're realizing in your brain that Lion Cat, who is in every single panel that's on this ship, because never leaves the Will's side almost ever, and when asked to, throws a giant fit about it, isn't in any of these panels. And you're just like, shit, where? come on, really? Really?
I mean, yeah, I know you killed the stock. I know you killed Barr. I know but there's a point where you just don't get to kill anybody.
You don't get to kill Lion
Cat.
As
long as by anybody else, me. Lion Cat.
You don't get to pull that out of me. But God, yeah. So the saga is just rife.
I cannot reckon enough. Amazingly approached for something completely effed up. Because it is effed up. It is the most bizarre, but yet immersive verse.
It's universal. Its themes are universal. And like we said back when it was like one of our recommended readings, is it reads, you're thrown into the world, not unlike Star Wars from the New Hope on, where the stock is almost like, I would equate that almost to the death of Aunt Beru and Uncle Ben, where you're like, their character,
Uncle Owen, Uncle Ben was the rice.
Or the
catalyst fire.
Yeah, I was getting ahead of myself, actually. And then the death of Marco's father is like the death of Ben Kenobi, where early on they give you that death and you're like, okay, I felt some general pull towards these characters, and okay, they're dead, that I feel something, but not, I don't feel something as much for that character as I do for the supporting characters that cared about that character. And then they kill, and then Ben dies, and you're just like, what? This is the first, you can't.
He's the guy who's supposed to be, you know, he's the mentor. He's supposed to be there all the time.
Yeah, so, God, Saga. Yeah, no.
And
no.
I think one of the other moments that really struck was when they're, it's punctuated, it's this ongoing, it would be like, in a way that a series of events somehow manages to take a story that be trying and to the point of just downright annoying.
Right.
And it's just consistent ordeal, yet pulls it off and the occasional turn of good fortune. This has enough turns that you don't become down by the constant deal, especially the Mark Milanimus face is this social pariah's every conceivable angle. There are other deaths very strike, because Brian K. Vaughan does really a job making really care about characters, even ones that aren't necessarily the best attention to the characters, and then knows how to kill his children in that way a great author can and get away with it. But the other thing he does is take his character, these trials, this is a hero's journey. Hazel tells a story. Of course, the narrator, you pretty much figure their offspring's gonna live because you tell them tale. It's like Clockwork Orange. You know, Alex is gonna make it through everything. Otherwise, he couldn't tell you, brothers, about his trials. Because he had his egg wigs and steak wakes.
And his
milk loss, whatever, milk, bah. But there's one of the wonderful trials, is the breakdown of Alana and Mark's relationship when they're at this point where they finally found peace.
Yeah.
And Marco's damn near have an affair with Jenny.
Right.
and coming to senses and, you know, in exile, having tend to war veteran all bandaged up so nobody recognizes him, takes on his father's name, R. And there's a wonderful scene at a point where he's come to senses and wants to commit himself to, reviving and rebuilding his family. And, Jenny is saying something referring to him as Bar. He says, Bar is my father's name. I have a right to sully this or something like that. It's like, God damn it. Damn you, my people. It's just such good writing.
Yeah, it's so, if you haven't, yeah, there's a lot of that moment wins. And I have a feeling that comic will act as an ambassador in the same way that a Watchman or, even a Sin City or something like that would have done for our generation past, where it's going to really alert a generation that comics aren't just one constant event or reboot or recontinuity or, over and over with guys in tights beating each other up. This is the clarion call that this is art and not just funny books, which, and again, we wouldn't have a show if there was anything wrong with just funny books, but
absolutely.
But there is more. That's the reason we're doing this show, that there is more to it. Speaking of, more than just funny books, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about where it all started for me. And I've talked about this on the show previously, but one of the ones I wanted to get to mentioning was back in, I believe it was 1986. So I would have been all of 9 years old. I read comics probably when I was 7, 8, 9. And I don't even at this point, I can't point to this book and say this was my comic book awakening. I think that anybody of my generation, of even of Cole's generation, we kind of look to Watchmen, or we look to The Killing Joke, or we look to, Death, something like that as the real kind of touchstone storytelling moment, which we say comics are more than just more than just the entertainment. They're worth more than the paper they're printed on. But my real awakening, that moment when, for me, that set me on the course, I think, that ended with me here talking to Cole every week for an hour for 221 issues of this show, was back then, and it had to have been on a rack in a supermarket. There was a Captain America comic book, and I think that we've talked about this, but it was issue 321. And I remember it. I can almost visualize exactly what it was, because it was the issue with Captain America. Mike Zeck drew it, where it's a black background. It has that classic Captain America log line across the top, and then it's Cap with that Uzi firing it off.
Oh yeah,
that's not. And I saw it, and Cap had always been and continues to be one of my absolute favorite comic book characters. And I'm like, this isn't Captain America. Like, Captain America doesn't have an Uzi. What is this? So I convinced Mom or Dad to buy it for me, and I took it home. It was probably Dad, because I don't think Mom would have ever bought me that comic. But I took it home and read it, and it changed something fundamental in me about what comic books were supposed to be. Because the whole story is that there's a fascist order. It was Ultimatum, which stands for the most ridiculous thing in the world.
It was actually, somebody had to spell all that out like sheep.
Yeah, it was underground.
I thought they just simply called themselves Tomato.
It was Underground Liberated Totally Integrated Mobile Army to Unite Mankind.
Good God, that's worse than like trying to come up with some anagram of Cobra.
Right, they were
it's like the guys at Spec were like, I thought we went along, did.
But it's a racist fascist organization run by the Flag Smasher. Who?
Yes, the Smasher.
I would love if anybody from Marvel Legends is listening. I would love to have a Flag Smasher Marvel Legends figure.
Even if we just had to have, like, Flag Smasher.
Oh, that'd be so good. But it reads initially through most of it as, and the thing about that Mike Zeck did so well with the cover and Grunwald did with the story is, you don't put that on the cover and give it to a 10-year-old kid and expect them to not want the first page of the comic to be that.
Yeah.
So you're reading through, waiting for that to happen, and it reads like fairly regular Captain America fare. He discovers that Ultimatum's going to hijack a plane, and he goes after, he infiltrates Ultimatum, dresses up like Ultimatum, part of the Ultimatum, like, it's as if, instead of the the Nazis being dressed by Hugo Boss, they were dressed by Karl Lagerfeld. There's a nice, like, high collar jacket and a jaunty beret that they all wear. But you get, along with all of that get up, you get an Uzi. I guess they're just issued with the fall fashion.
I don't know. Did Israel have sale or something?
Right. Everybody gets an Uzi, or as my grandma
called him. Israeli surplus Uzi. We made too many.
Or as my grandma called him whenever we watched Miami Vice together, the Ussie. But he gets
not to be confused, the American-made Mac 10, which is very similar. very popular.
With Cole.
That's right.
But no, he gets
welcome to the gun range. We're going to talk about Uzi and the Mac 10, two of the most popular small-arm machine guns of the 80s.
We
you couldn't win your dead cat with that. Actually, with the Uzi or Mac 10.
And now we're back to Hey Kids Cats. This issue is about swinging dead cats into things. What can't you hit with a dead cat when you swing it? But
pretty old leg cat. It's reaching.
He gets into a situation, into a hostage situation, and the only way out of this situation is to, he can't save the people and take out the terrorists with a shield. So he opens fire with a gun, you know, with the Uzi, takes the guy out. And that is the rest of this issue and next issue is Greg Grunwald heavy-handedly going through about how Cap never kills unless he's forced to. Like, and then it becomes
because it's apologetic.
Yeah, then it becomes a lodestone of, you know, of gun control and gun violence. But prior to that, as a 10-year-old or as a 9-year-old kid, I just watched Cap kill a guy with a gun. That never has happened before in my short expanse of reading comics. That is so outside the norm that it forced me. That was the moment that when I went back and really looked at who Captain America was, realizing, you know, that he was a soldier. And I think that opened up my love of digging into these characters and figuring out who they are and figuring out what the writer's motivations were for putting them in certain scenarios. Because it never occurred to me at that point that Cap would have been, you know, in the army or a soldier.
A proper military type.
Right,
and have that kind of martial skill.
But, you know, the emotional shock of reading your favorite character who, you know, never backs away from a fight, but always does it with a, you know, can fight 40 guys with a shield, you know, ping-panging it off the wall, defying all physics to make this thing work. And in this particular instance, can't do that and has to open fire with a gun. There was a range of emotion from, you know, almost betrayal to an understanding, to kind of an awakening into a world like that. Yes, this is different. This isn't, comic books aren't what I thought they were, which was, you know, Archie on a bed, you know, on a Sunday afternoon reading about Hercules beating up somebody in an Avengers bomber jacket. You know, this is more. And I think that that's why I think I can almost trace back my clinical love of comics to that. So that's a big moment win for me. It's a really cool little story arc if you can get your hands on it there. It's about 5 issues long, the Ultimatum Flag Smasher thing. But that's definitely kind of my moment, that my awakening moment into comics, you know?
No, absolutely. That's a fascinating story, too, because it's one of those moments where a writer has changed perception. Mm-hmm. Of a character, and I think that that's an amazing kind of moment win as in its own.
I agree. So do you have any?
Because it's rare that you know get that opportunity where someone takes that a different look at a certain character. One of the things, a kind of moment when it wasn't as foul or anything, but no less striking, because it was those moments when post Star Wars, there was a lot of science fiction getting folded into a lot of
every book.
Yeah, pretty much every. I mean, and you know, we're also talking about a period of a lot of different high impact. It's painfully obvious the route brought to us by Ridley Scott's Alien.
Right, they're Giger-esque.
Yeah, and they're, you know, very much a what if the X-Men had alien type character creatures in. But one of the things you would run into, John Byrne especially, is any time Fantastic Four or anybody else he's drawing got into space.
Yes.
Trial of Galactus. There would be like 100 different aliens you never seen before in a universe that has 100 different have seen.
Right, and chances are you were never going to see those aliens again.
Yeah, why do we need to draw a bunch of background aliens looking like nothing other than culled from John Byrne's sketch in lieu of having, you know, an established, recognized and established universe?
Right.
Why weren't these familiar faces invited to the party? And, you know, it's one of those stupid little nitpick things that bothered me, because why did you create a bunch of background aliens you never see again when there are aliens you've seen that, you know, at that point it comes like a Star Trek motion picture or whatever they had, whichever the hell one they had, big, you know, trial and exoneration Kirk. Where, you know, why can't we acknowledge there are alien races? I want to see, you know, brought the Klingons back. I want to see the modern cinematic take on the little gold guys, the Fezzes, the gilded Akbar and Jeff, during debate. What happened to that?
Not to go too off topic with what you're talking about now, but did you see that they released casting for Harvey Mudd for the new series?
No.
Yeah, the guy who played Dwight in The Office got cast, which I think is brilliant casting. So
nice.
Sorry, I don't want to.
Oh no, quite all right. But that, again, that's sort of keeping a universe where, you know, within its roots, you don't have to create a whole bunch of. I mean, it's nice to see new. Let's acknowledge the fact the old creature is still there, episode 7. What? So, you know, essentially, one of the things really struck as brilliant was when the Teen Titans jumped on the sci-fi bandwagon. And granted, one of their characters was sci-fi. The Firestar was established as an extraterrestrial.
Right.
Starfire.
Firestarter?
Firestar, not the...
I was really hoping you said Firestarter. It's like, wait, did I miss it?
I love you! I just suddenly see Scott's head.
Harry Hamlin runs it. It's a whole thing.
Oh, yeah. So, missiles are flying. Oh, wait, that's dead. Anyway.
We can't stay on track. We're trying real hard.
No, we cannot. But when the Titans went and Black Star came, took Starfire away, and then the whole, you know, her race and the Scions and the whole nine yards, when the Titans went to battle on other planets, there were 4 or 5 distinct species that you saw over again. And I thought, establish 4 species for the Vagan system, and let's see them. Example, you had these tusky, purplish, forearm guys, and you had these great, big, enormous ebony guys and fezzes, and you had these lizard guys with yellow spacesuits and pain sticks that got from the Klingons. And you got at the Scion, you saw these races played out again. And so it wasn't like, here's the one guy of this race, like the little suits or something, where most of the alien races look human anyway.
Right.
And it's just a neat little thing, and unfortunately that all of those races, to my knowledge, except maybe the Scions, just kind of disappear. Nobody else picked them up, and that's one of the big complaints I have, editorially speaking. I mean, it's great to have some blood. Don't do it to the complete exclusion. And I think it's one of those things where I came to realize this is a really good idea, is going to have these consistent species that occur throughout the storyline.
Yeah.
And that's it. Don't have to have 40 different singular versions, one of, you know, all these different drawings. Otherwise, it just becomes a living sketchbook in the background.
Right.
That's you would cool, see yeah. crowds.
I guess I never really thought about that. But yeah, Marvel was always bad about that. Like, if you look at, like, the Star Jammers.
Yeah. Do we ever encounter Skunk Bull or giant lizard people with one of those little fuzzy things on a string? Kind of like wind through fingers, make them think it's alive, only in white.
Like, yeah, you never. That's a really good point, because you had, you know, like, if you look at Marvel, hell, even if you look at DC to some extent, you know, you have.
Well, the Omega Men DC start, where you had a single representative of 7 distinct species, and never saw more than.
That's true. And when you did, it was a scandal.
Yeah, it was a big deal. Lobo was the last. Apparently, everybody else last. They never encountered another one.
Well, when we were,
For God's sake, Star Wars, I'm the Cantina Band guy, the Bith species from Cantina Band. There was a guy that was just there as a patron. I'm not with band.
I'm
just here drinking.
I follow this band like it was fish. Like, we're the last two of this race.
I just happened to, you know, if you're on Tatooine, I finally get away from my annoying people, and there's a whole band of another drink.
So when we were talking about a saga, we were talking about the power of the narrative power of death and what it means, killing your children, right? Like you can create these things and with the knowledge that what you're going to do is take them off the board in such a way that it creates a narrative vacuum that you're forced to recognize, that you're forced to see and examine and experience. You know, for me, you and I have seen a lot of comic book character death in our time for a lot of different reasons. We've seen it for the infamous, if you go back and you listen to the collector's sector for United States of Geekdom, oh, when they killed Johnny Storm.
Oh.
And they had the silent issue for the next issue. Like, all of those things where they're literally just grabs. When they killed Wolverine, but they killed him over you know, like a 6-issue miniseries, and you got to have the Harrison Ford Han Solo, the best day of your life, Make a Wish Foundation 6 issues before you died. But for me, the one that, and this is going to be really strange, but the comic book death that had, I think, the biggest impact on me reading it was, and this is my moment when I realized, even at, and I didn't read this until, what, maybe 10 years ago, that even as a jaded-ass adult comic book reader, I could still be moved by a creator using a character's death in such a way to tell a story that kind of wrenches at you, was... Mm-hmm. There was a book, and in this context, which I never thought it was going to happen in, which was Infinite Crisis. If you remember Infinite friggin' Crisis, there was the countdown to Infinite Crisis. And the whole story, it's Greg Rucka, who, if you've never read anything by Greg Rucka, you should. The guy can write mystery like nobody. He's a mystery writer that chose comic books as his medium, and good God, he's good. But the whole story revolves around the idea that someone is filtering money from Cord Inc. And they can't figure out where it is. Something is going on. There's some cover-up. And Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle, figures out something's happening. And he starts going to all these respective characters asking for help. So he goes to Batman. Batman blows him off. He's a joke, right? And that's, I think, the reason that I love this so much is because when you look at Blue Beetle, he uses non-lethal weapon. He's kind of a goofy inventor. He's never been an A-lister. He's always been comedic relief. He's always been the good-hearted hero. But he starts going to all of these, you know, he goes to Booster, and Booster can't help him. And he goes to Batman, and Batman blows him off. And he goes to Maxwell Lord, who, you know, was his one-time benefactor and leader for the Justice League, when it was Justice League International. And and Maxwell Lord, everybody blows him off, but he knows that something's going on. He goes to Superman, and he goes to the Green Lantern, and he's explaining what's going on, and he explains that Cord had 100 pounds of kryptonite that got stolen, and they decide they're going to, you know, well, we'll look into it, we'll figure it out. Superman obviously doesn't like that, but you know, the only person in the entire DC universe that he goes to and talks to that believes him is Wonder Woman. And she is supporting him and basically saying, I have your back, we'll figure this out. Well, he traces the money all the way back to, I think, Switzerland. And he goes to Switzerland to figure out what's going on. And there's been attempts on his life, and his house has been blown up, and Booster Gold's been hospitalized through this entire process. And he goes, he gets in the in his owl ship. No,
his bug. Bug.
I know. It's a Watchmen joke. He gets it, and it's very much like a
Watchmen. I should have known.
He gets in the bug ship, and he goes after he runs it down, because no one will go with him. No one will take him seriously. He is going to, by God, he's going to prove that something's happening, and he's going to be taken seriously. And he goes, and he finds Maxwell Lord, and he finds the headquarters of Checkmate, which is basically DC's S.H.I.E.L.D. And he finds Maxwell Lord, and he goes and he confronts Maxwell Lord, and he says, you've done this, you've taken my money, you've taken my technology, why? You know, and
my kryptonite.
What's that?
My kryptonite.
Yeah, you've taken my kryptonite, why? And Maxwell Lord, you know, says, he's like, listen, here's what's going on.
All I've got left is a pocket.
Damn it. He's like, I've taken it, you know, I've taken it from you, there's nothing you can do about it. I've built this database. I've stolen Batman's, you know, Batman satellite. I've built this database, and what we've done is we're watching every single superhuman, and there's nothing you can do about it. And Booster Gold says, you know, go to, you know, they're like, throw him in prison, throw him in jail, whatever it is. And Booster Gold's like, you know, basically, you know, screams you can go to hell. At which point, Maxwell Lord pulls out a gun and shoots Booster Gold in the head.
Blue Beetle.
Yeah, thank you. Blue Beetle in the head. And I was shocked. Like, I literally, no way did I expect that to happen. Nobody had set that up. Nobody had said that was going to happen. This is Blue Beetle. Who shoots Blue Beetle in the head?
It was also, you know, you're building on two sides of the same coin, and that point is universe in which Blue Beetle exists. The opposite, transverse of that being readership. Those who've read the comics are familiar with character. And in both cases, nobody really is prepared to take Beetle as a hardcore, serious, Batman-level detective, Superman-level superhero.
Right.
And what is done brilliantly here by Rucka is he takes this character that is the happy-go-lucky, you know, I'm having fun and bust chops superhero, puts him in a boy who cried kind of situation, and then the wolf devours him, and all of a sudden no one can really figure out how to process that on both sides of that, because you're not expecting this, you know, rough and tumble yuckster to ever, this is not how Beetle dies. Beetle dies as an old man when Cake Boss comes and eats his brain in.
Right. No, you're exactly right. And the other side is he's you're absolutely right. It's a boy that cried wolf scenario coupled with the idea that the comic book is teeters on a precipice of all these different things happening at once. So the concept of Infinite Crisis is that all these things are happening at once. All the supervillains have banded together, and they form basically a Legion of Doom, and they are methodically taking out all the other superheroes. At the same time, you know, all the magic shit's going crazy, and the Spectre seems to be possessed, so all the magic characters are trying to deal with that. Then you got Blue Beetle showing up at the Watchtower saying, somebody stole my kryptonite, and they kind of ruffle, you know, it's almost like ruffling the head of the younger brother, like, you know,
yeah.
I know this feels real serious to you, but the adults are talking, so...
Exactly.
You know...
Go back and get your shine box!
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, because I think in a lot of ways we all identify with that. We all identify, and like I said, I've seen, you know, we've been through the dark age of comics. We've been through the Punishers and the Wolverines, and I'm the best at what I do, Bob, and cutting people, and you know, the Scourge and reboots that have killed, you know, the Crisis. The crisis on multiple Earths. We've been through all of that.
Well, the dad that don't.
Right.
And this was, in many ways, one of the most real deaths, because there was just, in that moment, there's this sudden realization, this one's a stick, I think. There are no Lazarus Pits or Kryptonian icon or Kryptonian eradicators.
And you almost get, and the thing that Rucka, God, it's done so brilliantly that when it happens, and you never see it on page, it almost feels like the DC Universe stops in that moment. All this other stuff, it you're given the impression, and you never see it, you never witness it, that everything just kind of grinds to a halt for a second, and then and even now I'm getting a little, you know, I'm starting to feel that emotion again of reading it for the first time, because it's Blue Beetle, for shit's sake. Nobody kills the Blue Beetle, nobody uses the Blue Beetle in this fashion. And they did, and shit, it was powerful. So that showed me that, you know, this old dog can still feel things when it comes to comics that I hadn't felt in a really long time. So
it's rather remarkably brought up, that kind of death, because that did sort of jog a memory I didn't even have in my notes of one of those moments when, because it was an ironic win in that a character's death shook me more in the person of a character I really just happened to get exposed. And that was during a brief period when I was reading, I think it was Justice League International or one of those where they, it was a reboot where they, you know, playing at a lot of Justice laughs.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold and Elongated Man. You know, it was a little bit serious, a little bit tongue-in-cheek storyline. And what's her name? Sue Dibney. Played major role in that. And I just happened to fall in at a period like so many in my modern comic reading where I don't really read a lot of comics anymore. And if I do, I'm usually waiting and picking up a trade. And damn, if I didn't just absolute fall in love with Sue Dibney character. I always looked at Elongated Man as a ridiculous kind of extra plastic. What if you took Batman and Mr. Fantastic together? I really had no use for Game Man, and he had one of those Matt kind of names on top of everything else. So, you know, there was still a bias thing, a snotty teen collector years and my comic guy period. And here I was absolutely adoring this character, the way that she was presented, and it made her one of those rare, strong supporting characters that we talked about on the show, where sometimes the supporting cast gets a chance to do their job and just background fluff.
Right.
Or, you know, periodic damsels in distress. Or, oh, that Jimmy Olsen, I've got to get him out of another pickle. You know.
Yeah.
They, you know, were... And, you know, here was a supporting character really supporting the story. And, okay, no sooner do I've digested that than I'm hearing buzz about this identity crisis. So I'm going to pick this up. This looks like it's going to... Holy, did they know?
You're like, no, I
love... Just. You can't kill Sidney.
Yeah.
No, don't get... Do that. She become the lion cat. Of,
right.
So before I knew what that was, and it hit me. I realized that the impact that strong, because just by chance, I have two books that made that character even more powerful than she was in the context of that story before her demise.
Right, right.
Ugh. And that was one of those moments where you're like, this is, like with Blue Beetle, this is that sticks. When the supporting cast killed, 9 times out of 10, they never come back.
Yeah, there's no, unless you're Rick Jones, you're not coming back.
Yeah, exactly. Luck bastard.
Oh, man. Do you have any more on your grand list?
Yeah, there's a couple. One of them was one of my favorite things I picked up collected because it looked intriguing. It was Arkham Asylum Live Hell. I talked about it and recommend reading and may have brought this up then. Some of this may seem like a broken record if you have a very good memory for things that we said. We don't. So,
and we seem like a broken record.
If we repeat ourselves, it's old brain. But Arkham Asylum Living Hell is really a piece of work because it's a Batman story. It's more a Gotham City story. It's not really a Batman story. It's basically just taking you inside of Arkham Asylum. That's where the real action, Batman, yes, does appear. And there's a character that I just love and has apparently remained viable and active in DC, was the character of Humpty Dumpty.
Oh, yes, yes.
Who is one of those, it's the first time, to my knowledge, modern day someone wrote an old school Bat villain. Most of your modern Batman villains fit very well into our modern world. You don't get Mad Hatters and Tweedledees and Tweedledums, even Mr. Freezes, and
right.
Get retooled versions of the old characters to make dark, grittier, and more street and real. But you don't get anybody writing ridiculous characters in it.
Right. You don't.
And their ridiculousness are just as frightening as their serious ones. You don't get penguins in it.
No, yeah.
This time in Humpty Dumpty, somebody was writing a villain. In this case, you didn't know they were a villain. Their sole motivation was this sort of very simple-minded notion of needing to fix things. Right down to, in fact, killing grandma so he put her back together again, fix her.
The right way, yeah.
Yeah, get her, realize there's something wrong with grandma. I mean, just, all she needed was just a little retooling. But that everything tried fix, destroy.
Right.
And what struck me, not only that about this character, which was really in its own right, but what, and I can't remember who wrote that, but what the author does that is incredibly brilliant is why, you know, there's always these characters that get written in, like, you know, oh, Worf has a half-brother, apparently.
You are Star Trek heavy tonight. Is there?
I guess so. Yeah.
Is there something going on there?
I'm channeling the Gorn Arena, the sister show to the Rancor Pit. But you know, that's just one example I can cite out of probably hundreds of this tired chestnut, where characters come out of blue. And it's with a backstory.
Yeah.
That why, you know, how do you make that happen effectively? And what was brilliant, you know, with upwards of 12 titles in his heyday, you know, there are more Batman stories than you should stick at.
Sure.
You can't swing a dead cat without hitting Batman title. Nice. But what the Ollie does is, who brings Humpty Dumpty to justice? Batman. And at first it didn't strike until I was going back and I realized, holy crap, you know what you just did? You made Humpty Dumpty a Batville, not a Batman villain. That's why we're seeing Humpty Dumpty War, because Batgirl's adventures are not as heavily chronicled. And that, to me, and that, I made this realization that one of the most incredible conception presentation, because it was so subtle. It wasn't like, hey, guess what? Humpty's a Batgirl villain.
Right, she didn't swing in and go, he's one of mine, and then start fighting.
Yeah, exactly. It puts Batman out of its power. It's just, she's the one who happened to crack that case.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, crap, that is it. And it elevates Batgirl
yeah.
a little bit further. Not that she's a lot of, she doesn't get a lot of propping up, but anything that gives these second tier Bat family a chance to shine, I'm all for that too. But that really struck me. One of the other things, a moment when I talk often about Watchmen, you warn people this was going to happen. There were actually
right.
two things.
I got a Grant Morrison one lined up, so go right ahead.
Two things Watchmen struck was realization after being again and again and again how much of the general act of Watchmen takes place on St. Crossroads and Hat.
You are absolutely right, by the way.
And if you watch, you could actually sit down and draw a map. of exact modus opus in Watchmen are. They're within about two blocks of each other.
You can go on a walking tour of Watchmen. Yeah.
If you take these vendor stands, see exactly where it sits, where it is relative to Gunga Diner, the Institute for Extraspatial Studies, to, was it the big concert venue there? The Prometheus Cab it out, the Cab Cab, rather. If you want to say Grand Central Station, you know, the big event venue there that isn't real.
Yeah, I don't want to say where, Carnegie Hall, I can't remember.
Yeah, but at any rate, you can actually map it out, even right down to the restaurant Laurie and Dan are, and even the comedian's apartment, everything within a short distance of each other. And, you know, that one really kind of struck. And it took me years and years and years of rereading and rereading and rereading, which I do about, I've often said, about four or five times a year, I'll pull out my trade paperback and reread the Watchmen cover to cover. The scene with Rorschach is in Blake's apartment with the closet with the false panel. In the movie, he just walks in, pushes the button, panel opens. Like, right. Okay. Thank you, Zach Shortcut Snyder. But there's a scene where it bugged the crap out of her several years, where he walks in, he's looking at the closet, puts his arm on the inside, puts his arm on the outside, gravels the coat hanger, puts it on the inside, puts it on the outside. Then he pushes the button. Oh, look, his costume. What the hell is all that other stuff of? And it's really brilliant visuals. And the coat hanger makes sense, but really less there Rorschach, more there as a visual for the audience, because you really don't notice. It's very subtle. He's got his arm on the outside of the closet.
Yeah.
The exterior is his entire arm. The interior, his elbow's bent.
So you get the idea that it's a false back on it.
Exactly. Coat hanger terms it, because the crook in the coat hanger comes up flush exterior wall of the closet, the little wardrobe, but it comes up, the crook comes up flush with the interior wall, but it is further into the exterior.
That's amazing.
And when I finally made that realization, it's like, okay, Ichi, this is...
They done it.
S-O-U, this is that synergy artist and writer that I absolutely adore. Mm-hmm. And I'm always hoping I tell that story, people will go back like, that's what that's all about.
Like, I never...
And you're welcome, years of obsessing, rereading, finally sitting down and scratching that jeweler's look. And...
Well, you always said you've reread it how many times now, and you always find something else. Something
oh, yes. That, yeah, that's a good point. Years and years of rereading, I would constantly find things that I'd never noticed. And it's like, oh my God, that was all, and it's all already there. It's one of those incredibly reapproachable books, but it continues to give, continues to grow.
That's awesome, man. That's really, really cool. I've only got one more that I wrote that I actually made note of, and it's that moment when a comic book made me feel bad about myself.
Oh, no.
And it was in Doom Patrol, in Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol, and it's one thing I've got the omnibus of Doom Patrol. One thing I cannot suggest, one thing I'm actually telling you not to do, is to try to sit down and read this thing just every night until you're done, because you will go insane. You will lose your damn mind. It's dense. It covers a lot of kind of esoteric topics, everything from like chaos magic to religion to, you know, there's a character in there that we'll talk about at some point that's a literal street. There's a sentient street.
Oh, yes. That was in that later big ring binder edition. Who's Who put me off to it. They had like Johnny the Street
Johnny
or whatever.
Johnny the Street. It's a sentient street that becomes a character in much the same way Mogo is the planet home base of the Green Lanterns. You know, it becomes the home base for the Doom Patrol, and it's a sentient street. It's amazing. It's weird and esoteric and amazing. But every once in a while, they would throw in like a weird kind of, you know, break the continuity, waka waka kind of funny, strange one-shot type issues in there. And one of them that really threw me off and made me really, it opens on a guy dressed sort of like one of the watchdogs or one of, you know, like traditional, let's say, B comic book villain jumpsuit garb, right? Couple pouches,
yeah.
a bandolier strap, a gun holster, you know, it's kind of an orange costume. And it opens on this guy, and he's assassinates somebody and then proceeds to shave his face. And then it cuts to a splash screen, like nobody does blah, 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 to the Beard Hunter. And it's the Beard Hunter. And I literally laughed out loud. Like, I saw it. It was so well depicted. I did one of the, Bahas! Like, out loud when I was reading it. And as you go through, it gets more and more ridiculous. The first half of this comic book is more and more ridiculous. There's a beard association, and they've put a beard hit out on Professor Calder's, Dr. Calder's.
Oh, yeah. Miles Calder, yeah.
Miles Calder, yeah. For his magnificent beard. So they put a hit out through the beard hunter on this guy's on his beard. But the story that they're telling as it unravels. So you're laughing hysterically at this thing, but as they unpack and unfold this story, you find out that the beard hunter lives at home with his mother at age 36. His father had a magnificent beard, but because of like a weird facial alopecia thing, he could never grow a beard. And you know, he spent all of his time reading like bodybuilding magazines, and like the implication is that he's struggling with his own sexuality and his relationship with his father, and that's why he's taken up this mantle of the beard. And it's really, really in depth, and you start really feeling bad for this guy.
Oh,
so
wow.
The first two pages, you literally laugh out loud, and by the end, you are, you know, they end up catching him and bringing him to justice, you know, through a series of like fake beard, like, you know, like really kind of Waka Waka type stuff. But you feel so bad for this character who's obviously struggling mentally to come to terms with so many things in his life.
And see how this sort of ridiculous notion comes the sympathetic character.
Yeah.
And at least in my mind, folks, that episode of Family, Jody was trying to join that gang, and his initiation was to snip some of Mr. French's beard off.
and then
Mr. French goes ballistic, talking about how long it took him to grow that beard. I'm like, bullshit. It doesn't take that long to grow.
And, you know, the end is, and he wants to be an A-list supervillain and get the recognition. And, you know, the comic ends on him saying, well, at least if I go through all this stuff, they'll make a movie about me one day. And it's,
on Lifetime.
It's issue 45 of Doom Troll. And if you get a chance to pick it up and read it, it's heartbreaking. But you laugh at the beginning, and then by the end, you feel bad about yourself for laughing without knowing anything. It's the weirdest, most specific reaction I've ever had to a comic book in my life. Like, I literally felt bad at my, I was mad at myself for laughing. Well, you didn't know his whole story. You laughed at him. You laughed at him early, but you didn't know what he was going through.
You didn't walk a mile in his four color shoes.
I'm having a conversation with myself about a comic book character called the Beard Hunter. That is a moment when you realize the power of just, you know, that's that Alan Moore, Grant Morrison power to take Swamp Thing and make him this sympathetic character that you want to go on this journey with. You know, that is what a comic book is, and that's why I do this show every week, because of the Beard Hunter or the Blue Beetle. It's amazing. It's comic books are amazing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Are those holy crap? It's when I couldn't even tell you what it was like in a Batman attack. What was the one, Shadow of the Bat, or you know, any of the
Bat,
you know, Smacks. Raspberry Ripple Batman, whatever
right.
The difference were, and
Fiesta
you
Conker
had.
Batman.
That's right. You got to the point where there was one that I was following a storyline in. It was really kind of interesting. And Batman was going around trying to, like, you know, all the potential, all the usual suspects incarcerated. This murder mystery. I wish I knew. So I tried desperately to try to find out what this was. But there was somewhere in the context of the storyline, he goes to Arkham or contacts Arkham and has compelled them to count Mr. Zaz, his hash mark.
Yeah.
He's cut his body. You know, all the hash marks are to the last tally. So, you know, it can't have been Zaz. And then there's this wonderful, just holy shit panel where, you know, the people who've gone, I guess, to the tally, the body check, are exiting. He sits down on this bench, puts a leg up on his, and there's a fresh scar on the sole.
Oh, that's awesome.
And you just, like, even telling it, I'm feeling chills that I felt then. It's like, that is some powerful storytelling there. You, you just did not see that. We're going somewhere else with this.
That's,
and like, oh,
that's a verbal Kent end of Usual Suspects moment where you're just like, holy shit, I never would have ever seen
you
that.
You got me.
Yep. Yep. You and got there, everybody.
There are so many more. I'm going to actually touch on, we've got an upcoming episode.
Yeah.
Cattail, that is about what I consider best comics ever written that nobody ever read, because it's in a genre that'd be otherwise reasonably dismissed.
Nose thumbed.
Yeah, just why ever explore genre? Because like in any genre, there are those gems that are out there, and that is Omaha the Catnip, talking about Reed Waller, and especially when Kate Worley came on board, what started its life as a fact horror comic, and then came among the best written kind of a, it's in there with like things like the drama comic strips, like Apartment
right.
10 or whatever, you know. It was just an ongoing storyline that just happens to be mature enough its approach that, and being a deliberately adult comic where it has a lot of influence. So I just want to kind of set that up. Talking about some of I've sent in a collection to put under his bed to read later.
yeah, I got it in a shoebox. Don't worry.
You got it under the mattress. But talking about those things then, it did occur to me, you can't escape Alan Touch Allen, especially a thing like this. It was in his run on the American published Miracle.
Okay.
Where he took laughable, ridiculous character, Shazam, Captain Marvel ripoff, Marvel. It was rebranded as Miracle Man. It had been in litigation hell forever. Marvel published a series of ripoff hardcovers. I don't know if they've ever finally got into putting them in ripoff softcover, put a bunch of fluff in that didn't belong. But in Alan Moore's run, it's a wonderful, there's this like spook show Black Ops kind of character. Ashley is just one of the most brilliantly written characters of that type. Or, you know, he'll go and charm his way into the hospital, so smart guy
right.
that saw too much, or plies him for information by promising not to kill him, and says, remember when I told you I wasn't going to kill you? I lied, and he just smiled. But I have to set that care up, because there's this moment when that is brilliantly illustrated as both he and the human catalyst for Marvel Miracle, character's name escapes me, but they're basically in the clutches of that character, Dr. Savannah, Dr. Emil Gargunza, his estate in South America, and they've just been sort of set on the deadliest prey kind of hunt where Miracle Dog is after, which is... Essentially, you know, when they were experimenting with alien technology, they had this hideous, monstrous, deadly, huge talons and fangs on hot pursuit. And the whole story up to a point is told from Ashley Cream's point of view. Up to the point he is effectively cornered by this creature. And savagely realized that at the beginning of the story, you just have this extreme close-up of Ashley Cream's face and neck. And there's this whole thing about this big drop of blood just sort of hanging at the end of a leaf of grass. Mm-hmm. And slowly building momentum to drop free. And by the point you get the reveal, it's that his head was severed and is lying there upright, watching his drop his own blood fall as consciousness fades.
So those were his fleeting last moments.
And it's just like, you know, it was a harrowing tale at point. All of a sudden,
man,
you just feel like you punched gut.
Yeah.
And it was another one of these cases where really came to love this really kind of, you know, borderline evil character who's gone rogue. And then all of a sudden, death is one found just gut-wrenching of Indian comics. We'll now return you to your regularly scheduled Hey Kids Comics on these and other fine stations.
I like this character that you're developing, the sheriff in I like the sheriff in every Stephen King novel. This is good. I think you should keep working on this. But
comic
yeah, so
a radio announcer.
So if, I like weird mass. I like weird New England radio announcer. I like him. I like him a lot, actually. I like him a lot.
Now that we have me round fire, it's time again for Adventure Comic Covers.
We're bringing him back for comic covers. When we do it, we're bringing him back. But yeah, we really hope that this issue, we were excited about doing it. It's been on the books for a really long time. And the hope is that again, we challenge you to read comics in different ways, to look at them not as just funny books, but as, you know, as labors of love and as literary achievements and artistic achievements. So I hope that this has helped you on that path a little bit. I know it's helped us.
And also chisel away at the layers. I mean, they're not all going to be jammed. But to chisel away at the layers, sometimes you'll find things you didn't expect that were there all along.
Exactly.
Like being those people that live underground in Australia and mine all the gems out, and they literally chisel their house out of the walls of all of the strata that they're getting the gems out of. And one day you're like, oh, we should expand the living room. Hey, look, a giant.
Is that a diamond?
Here's a giant opal. Who knew? That finance. What the hell? Let's build a rumpus of money.
Let's build a cave rumpus room.
Yeah, it's like the troglodytic Flintstone, right? Look it up.
The troglodytic Flintstones.
More like Flintstones. The troglodytic Flintstones.
I had a case of the troglodytic Flintstones.
Oh, wow.
Man, you got to get that.
It's hard to pass. You know, yeah. You got to get a lot of grand apple.
Ultrasonic, got to break that up. You got to break that up inside of you. You got to get a big old toucan. You pull on its tail, and then it goes, and then it breaks up the troglodytic Flintstone in there. there.
And a turkey bird.
Turkey bird. You need a damn turkey bird. Damn it. Why don't you plug us up? And I know we have a lot of plugs to talk about.
We need to close sucker out because we have, there is more stuff going on the Swing a Dead Cat app. But
join us
now,
next week for more Swing a Dead Cat.
That's right. The cattails. We swing dead cats by the tail.
Nice cattails. I like it.
Yes, indeed. We are, of course, coming to you from the Jedi Cole Universe, slowly getting the ship righted, getting the shows back up on time, and home of the Hey Kids Comics, the Rank Pit. We're going to see a lot of shows coming up. Nerding will be back. Bless the guys. Nerding is sending me like 5 episodes in the last 2 months that I have yet to put on the site. Be working on that. And of course, we're at JediCult.com, and you can check out the Ranker Pit there or the Ranker Pit Live every other on first and third Sundays of the month over at WatchOnAirLive.com from 2 to 1 Central with myself and comparable Eddie Medina, your favorite Star Wars guys. Speaking of which... I don't think I'm jumping the gun here because of how it's going to be, but as you're listening to this, we will have made the announcement that Ranker Pit Roadshow Summer Invasion has been announced. We're doing a lot of appearances as the Ranker Pit. I'm going to let the cat out of the bag on one of them right now. In May, Dallas at Famous Monsters Convention, Dallas, Texas, May something. Apparently not this particular calendar, but
but that's what the internet's for. Look it up.
Famous Monsters, the 26th to 28th on May 27th. I feel still waiting to get the final on when we schedule the Ranker Pit Roadshow, making one of its summer invasion stops at Famous Monsters. Thank you very much to the folks on that convention for letting us bring the show on the road to that show. We'll also be returning to the DFW G.I. Joe show, as talked about here before. We'll be at ArlingCon. Eddie and I will also be going to be launching the summer invasion over at... Burleson, Texas, Burleson Rec Center's annual Star Wars Day. We've been apparently invited back for that again this year to MC and host the costume contest and some of the other events at Ranker Pit. And we'll be out there selling some Star Wars goodies as a fundraiser. And I hope to see you out there. Many, many Texas stops for that coming up on the Jedi Universe site and on the Ranker Pit Live. We're talking about that pretty much nonstop. And you can write to us at jcmail@yahoo.com. You can check out the occasional tweet, and I'll be tweeting a lot more, especially if the Red Show come up. And that will culminate in August at Infinicon in Addison, Texas. So we have, I believe, 6 or 7, 7 or 8 appearances in the Summer Invade Tour.
That's awesome. And, you know, if you're listening to the show and you like what you hear and you like the shows that you hear and you want to hear more, you want the quality to improve, you want to see more appearances, you know, head on over to iTunes. It's really important that if you like the shows that you go to iTunes and you go to the Jedi Cole Universe on iTunes and you rate and review the shows. That's what gets people to see it. That's what moves it up the ranks. That's what's going to allow us to find advertisers and finance some of these crazy things that are coming out of everybody's pockets right now that are doing this show. So head on over to iTunes, rate and review the shows. And with all that being said,
and also spread the word with friends, local comic shop. Let people know that we're out there. We produced over 200 hours, probably close to 250 or more hours of programming, possibly even dangerously close to 300 hours, given how we'll often go over. Just for this show alone, then another 150 or more of the Ranker Pit, both the recorded and live show, and dozens and dozens and dozens of hours of the other shows on AC. But you know, especially with the comics, Hey Kids Comics, let the comic shops, you know, we're out there. Let them see if you know, if we get the people asking after, like, maybe make up some flyers or store signs, something you can ask local comic shop to put up on the bullet board. Spread the word. Let people know you enjoy this show, because a lot more people would probably enjoy it just as much as you do. So
that's right. Absolutely.
You know, be like Spindly Bits and help spread the...
That's right, Spindly Bits. We haven't forgot about you. All right. With all that being said, don't forget to buy, collect, and enjoy your comics. And let us know. Send us an email. Send us a tweet. Get on Facebook. Let us know what your moment win was. We would love to hear it. So for Hey Kids Comics, I'm Andrew Farmer.
And I'm Cole Houston. We'll be back here next week, some more exciting college hoops. And the season's just going by way too fast. And we hope, but at least we'll be back next year with some really exciting young kids who are coming out the ranks.
College hoops. All right, everybody. First time I've ever heard Cole use the term.